Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and do one more practice round of my first year oral argument for the semifinals. My biggest reason for that is because I don't feel like my first practice went that great. So I do want to do one more. I did think that I was going to do this off audio, but I think it's better to have this in the microphone. It'll at least make me feel a little better prepared just to have an audience listening. So yeah, here we go. May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, my name is William Larson, and I represent the appellant, Blake Woodson, in this case. At this time, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Would the court like a brief recitation of the facts? Today, this court should adopt the approach taken by the majority of circuits and reverse the district court ruling by holding that new reliable evidence is defined as newly presented evidence. And it should do so for the following 3 reasons. First, the text and precedent cases, including Schlupp, House, and McQuiggan, states that the petitioner may show evidence that was not presented at trial. Second, the intent of the Supreme Court was to broadly allow new evidence. And third, there is a greater interest in avoiding a miscarriage of justice than there is in the finality of a sentence. Before getting into these arguments, I do want to reserve an argument that says even if the court here determines not to have a completely broad analysis, they should reserve the ability to hold that newly presented evidence should be admitted if it was withheld due to ineffective counsel. The first argument that I have is that the text in precedent cases says that new evidence is defined as newly presented evidence. In Schlepp, the plain language says that a petitioner is to present new reliable evidence, whether it be exculpatory scientific evidence, trustworthy eyewitness accounts, or critical physical evidence that was not presented at trial. There are 2 parts of this definition. First, you have what is required, new reliable evidence, and then at the end, you have the actual definition of that term that was not presented at trial. Several circuits have adopted this plain meaning by reading the text as it is and adopting it into the facts of the case. And that is true for the 2nd and 6th circuits. Additionally, even if the text is not seen as completely ambiguous, because it is actually plain, it's said several times in the Supreme Court in the majority opinion, that newly presented evidence is allowed. But even if that's not plain, as is said in the 9th Circuit, well, then you can look at the other parts of the text to determine the meaning of the Supreme Court. Other parts of the text say that newly presented evidence may be included, and we can see that through this phrase here. The emphasis on actual innocence allows the reviewing tribunal also to consider the probative force of relevant evidence that was either excluded or unavailable at trial. In this case, we have 2 parts of evidence that would be present, either excluded evidence or unavailable evidence. Excluded evidence shows that new evidence can be available, although it was specifically excluded. Second, if we look at the intent of the Supreme Court, it is defined to broadly allow new evidence. Schlepp was defined broadly. It allowed the actual innocence gateway to overcome a procedural barrier, and then House was also broad, allowing old and new evidence to overcome the same procedural barrier through the actual innocence gateway. McQuiggan was also broad, allowing new reliable evidence to overcome a statutory barrier, as is the case here. It makes sense that the Supreme Court would not intend a broad gateway and then have a narrow restriction on that gateway. The O'Connor concurrence could argue that new reliable evidence is defined as newly discovered evidence. However, the text, as we see there, if it is determined to be ambiguous, and O'Connor's concurrence was used just to clarify. If that text is ambiguous, well, then we need to rely on Gregg v. Georgia, which says that the concurrence could be the meaning of the text. However, O'Connor was also just used to overcome the dissent argument, and then also we have House and McQuiggan, which came after Schlepp, which interpreted things broadly, and then did not clarify, saying that this is newly discovered evidence. As a result, O'Connor's concurrence is simply that. It is a concurrence, and it does not apply any further than that. Third, there is a greater interest in avoiding a miscarriage of justice than there is in the finality of a case. It is true that there is an interest in both the finality of a case and... but there is a greater interest in avoiding that miscarriage of justice. This is mentioned specifically in Schlepp, recognizing both interests and then saying that a miscarriage of justice has a much greater interest than that finality and comity of a case. The Supreme Court in Schlepp shows that classic statement, saying that the courts would rather let 100 guilty men go free than let one innocent person be condemned and to die to a sentence that was not fitting for them. This is true with the statement today. Schlepp was decided in 1995. And there are still cases where people are actually innocent. 1 in 20 cases where people are condemned to die are actually innocent. This goes against the policy consideration that the appellee mentions as well, with the fear that there is going to be a flood of the judicial system if we adopt the broader approach. This is unpersuasive because new reliable evidence is unavailable in the vast majority of circumstances. Having a narrow approach would thus put another roadblock to having access to avoid a miscarriage of justice. For these reasons, the court should reverse. However, if the court determines to interpret a new reliable evidence broadly, narrowly, it should allow an exception where new reliable evidence allows newly presented evidence that was withheld due to ineffective counsel. Several circuits have recognized this, both circuits that have adopted a broad and a narrow approach. Those circuits that have adopted a narrow approach, specifically the Third Circuit, recognized that their adoption of a narrow approach was too harsh on petitioners. And as a result, they carved out this exception into their narrow adoption to mitigate those harsh effects. I see my time has expired. May I briefly conclude? Of course. Your Honors, this court should reverse its ruling and hold... it should reverse the ruling of the district court and hold that new reliable evidence is new presented evidence. Thank you. Alrighty. That wasn't as good as I was hoping for, but still not terrible. I'll keep practicing. A few more runs should be good. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is, if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join Law Schoolers Pro. And you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't are pre-law materials, and the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice, and with that, the fourth thing is, if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.